It was a vote of the Assembly proposed by a tribune and overturning the nomination of the Senate that put Marius in charge of the war against Jugurtha. This procedure had been used in one or two emergencies before, but in 108 BCE it came as a powerful assertion of the right of the people as a whole, rather than the Senate, to decide who was to command Rome's armies. No sooner had Marius secured Roman victory in Africa and returned to Rome with Jugurtha in chains than another general was sacked by popular vote after suffering a terrible defeat at the hands of German invaders from across the Alps. In an atmosphere of panic, which included a rare repetition of state-sponsored human sacrifice in Rome, his command too was assigned to Marius, who proceeded to justify the people's hopes and send the invaders packing. Marius came to a sad end. He was already almost 70 years old when a tribune tried to use a vote of the popular assembly to transfer one last military command to him. This time it was without success, for this was 88 BCE. The command was against King Mithridates, and the rival commander was Sulla, who marched on Rome to prevent any such transfer. While Sulla was away in the east, Marius died, a few weeks into his seventh consulship, to which he had been elected as an anti-Sullan candidate. Some claimed that in his deathbed hallucinations he acted as if he had won the command against Mithridates and issued instructions to his carers as if they were soldiers going to battle. It was a pitiful story of a deluded old man, but the principle of popular control of appointments abroad that he had championed was often reasserted over the following decades. Assemblies of the people repeatedly voted vast resources to those they were persuaded could best undertake the defence or expansion of Rome's empire. In effect, they voted autocrats into power. As the case of Pompey shows, Pompey the Great, as he called himself, but the butcher to others. Pompey the Great. Just 4 years after his prosecution of Verres, in 66 BCE, Cicero addressed the Roman people in a public meeting on the security of the empire. Now a praetor, and with his eyes on the consulship, he was speaking in support of a proposal by a tribune to put Pompey in command of the long-running on-and-off war against the same king Mithridates, whom the Romans had been fighting with mixed success for more than 20 years. Pompey's powers were to include almost complete control over a large swathe of the eastern Mediterranean for an unlimited period. With more than 40,000 troops at his disposal and the right to make peace or war and to arrange treaties more or less independently. Cicero may have been genuinely convinced that Mithridates was a real threat to Rome's security and that Pompey was the only man for the job. From the heartland of his kingdom on the Black Sea, the king had certainly scored occasional terrifying victories over Roman interests across the eastern Mediterranean, including, in 88 BCE, a notorious and highly mythologized massacre of tens of thousands of Romans and Italians on a single day. Exploiting what must have been a widespread hatred of Roman presence and offering added incentives, any slave who murdered a Roman master was to be freed, he coordinated simultaneous attacks on Roman residents in towns on the west coast of what is now Turkey, from Pergamum in the north to Kaunas, the fig capital of the Aegean in the south, killing, in highly inflated Roman estimates, somewhere between 80,000 and 150,000 men, women and children. If even nearly on that scale, this was a cold, calculating and genocidal massacre. But it is hard to resist the feeling that by the 60s BCE, after the campaigns of Sulla in the 80s BCE, Mithridates might have been disruptive rather than dangerous, and that he had become a convenient enemy in Roman political circles. A bogeyman to justify potentially lucrative campaigns, and a stick with which to beat one's rivals for their inactivity. Cicero also more or less admitted to having been leaned on by commercial interests in Rome. Anxious about the effect of prolonged instability, real or imaginary, in the East on their private profits, as much as on the finances of the state. The boundary between the two was carefully blurred. In making the case for this special command, Cicero pointed to Pompey's lightning success the previous year in clearing the Mediterranean of pirates, also thanks to sweeping powers voted by a popular assembly. Pirates in the ancient world were both an endemic menace and a usefully unspecific figure of fear, not far different from the modern terrorist, including anything from the navy of a rogue state to small-time human traffickers. Pompey got rid of them within 3 months, suggesting they may have been an easier target than they were painted, and followed up his success with a resettlement policy, unusually enlightened for either the ancient or the modern world. He gave the ex-pirates small holdings at a safe distance from the coast, where they could make an honest livelihood. Even if some fared no better than Sulla's veterans, one of those who did take well to his new life makes a lyrical cameo appearance in Virgil's poem on farming, The Georgics, written in the late 30s BCE. The old man is living peacefully near Tarentum in southern Italy, now an expert on horticulture and beekeeping. His piracy days are long behind him, instead planting herbs scattered among the bushes and white lilies all around, vervain and slender poppies. In his spirit he equalled the riches of kings. Cicero's underlying argument, however, was that new problems called for new solutions. The danger Mithridates posed to Rome's commercial revenues, its taxation income, and the lives of Romans based in the East demanded a change of approach. As the empire had expanded over the past 2 centuries, all kinds of adjustments had already been made in Rome's traditional system of office holding to cope with the demands of overseas government and to add to the available manpower. The number of praetors, for example, had increased to 8 by the time of Sulla. And there was now a regular system by which elected officials went to provincial posts abroad for a year or two as proconsuls or propraetors in place of consuls or praetors, after they had completed a year's duties in Rome. Yet these offices remained piecemeal and short-term, when what Rome needed in the face of an enemy such as Mithridates was the best general with a lengthy command over the whole area that might be affected by the war, with the money and soldiers to do the job, not hampered by the normal controls. There was predictable opposition. Pompey was a radical and ambitious rule-breaker who had already flouted most of the conventions of Roman politics that traditionalists were increasingly trying to insist on. The son of a new man, he had risen to military prominence by exploiting the disruption of the 80s BCE. When still in his 20s, he had put together 3 legions from among his clients and henchmen to fight on behalf of Sulla, and was soon awarded a triumph for chasing down Sulla's rivals and assorted enemy princelings in Africa. It was then that he gained the nickname Adulus Quintulus Carnifex, Kid Butcher rather than Enfant Terrible. He had held no elected office whatsoever when he was given by the Senate a long-term command in Spain to deal with a Roman general who had gone native with a large army, another hazard of a far-flung empire. Successful again, he ended up a consul for 70 BCE at the age of just 35 and bypassing all the junior posts, flagrantly at odds with Sulla's recent rulings on office holding. So ignorant was he of what went on in the Senate, which as consul he had to chair, that he resorted to asking a learned friend to write him a handbook of senatorial procedure. A few hints of the objections made to this new command can be gleaned from Cicero's speech. His enormous emphasis, for example, on the immediate danger posed by Mithridates. Letters arrive every day telling how villages in our provinces are being burnt. strongly suggests that some people did claim at the time that it was being blown out of all proportion as an excuse to give vast new powers to Pompey. The objectors did not win the day, though they must have come to feel that their fears were not unfounded. Over the next 4 years, under the terms of his new command, Pompey set about redrawing the map of the eastern part of the Roman Empire, from the Black Sea in the north to Syria and Judea in the south. In practice, he cannot have done this alone. He must have had the help of hundreds of friends, junior officers, slaves, and advisers. But this particular rewriting of geography was always, at the time, ascribed to Pompey himself. His power was partly the result of military operations. Mithridates was quickly driven out of Asia Minor to his territories in the Crimea, where he was later ousted in a coup by one of his sons and killed himself. And there was a successful Roman siege on the fortress at Jerusalem, where two rivals were contesting the high priesthood and kingship. But more of this power came from a judicious mixture of diplomacy, bullying, and well-placed displays of Roman force. Months of Pompey's time were devoted to turning the central part of Mithridates' kingdom into a directly governed Roman province, adjusting the boundaries of other provinces, founding dozens of new cities, and ensuring that many of the local monarchs and dynasts had been downsized and made obedient in the old style. In the triumph he celebrated in 61 BCE, after his return to Rome and on his 45th birthday, no doubt a planned coincidence, Pompey is said to have worn a cloak that once belonged to Alexander the Great. Where on earth he had come across this fake or piece of fancy dress is impossible to know, and he did not deceive many shrewd Roman observers who were no less sceptical about the authenticity of the fabric than we are. But it was presumably intended to match not only the name, the Great, that he borrowed from Alexander, but also the ambitions of far-flung imperial conquest. Some Romans were impressed, others decidedly dubious about the display. Pliny the Elder, writing just over 100 years later, singled out for disapproval a portrait head of Pompey that the general himself had commissioned, made entirely of pearl. The defeat of austerity and the triumph of luxury. But there was a bigger point. This celebration was the most powerful expression yet of the Roman Empire in territorial terms, and even of Roman ambition for world conquest. One of the trophies carried in the procession, probably in the shape of a large globe, had an inscription attached to it declaring that this is a trophy of the whole world. And a list of Pompey's achievements displayed in a Roman temple included the telling, if over-optimistic, boast that he extended the frontiers of the empire to the limits of the earth. The First Emperor. Pompey has a good claim to be called the first Roman emperor. True, he has usually gone down in history as the man who finally supported the cause of the Republic against the increasingly independent power of Caesar, and so as an opponent of imperial rule. But his treatment in the East and the honours showered upon him, or which he contrived, closely prefigured many of the defining elements of the Roman emperor's image and status. It was almost as if the forms and symbols of imperial rule that, a few decades later, under Julius Caesar, and even more his great-nephew, the Emperor Augustus, became standard in Italy and Rome, and had their prototypes in Roman rule abroad. Julius Caesar, for example, was the first living person whose head featured on a coin minted in Rome. Up to that point, Roman small change had paraded only images of long-dead heroes, and the innovation was a blatant sign of Caesar's personal power, followed by all later Roman rulers. But a decade earlier, communities in the East had produced coins showing Pompey's head. This honour went along with other extravagant compliments, and even various forms of religious cult. A group of Pompey worshippers, Pompeiastai, are known on the island of Delos. New cities took his name. Pompeiopolis, or Pompey Town. Magnopolis, or City of the Great. He was hailed as equal to a god, saviour, and even just God. And at Mytilene on Lesbos, a month in the calendar was renamed after him, just as, in Rome, months were later renamed after Julius Caesar and Augustus. There were precedents for many of these accolades individually. The kings who followed Alexander the Great in territories from Macedon to Egypt had often had their power expressed in more or less divine terms. Ancient polytheistic religions treated the boundary between gods and humans more flexibly and constructively than modern monotheisms. Earlier Roman commanders in the eastern Mediterranean had occasionally been honoured with religious festivals established in their names, and Cicero implies in a letter to Atticus from Cilicia that he has turned down the offer of a temple. Nonetheless, as a package, Pompey's honours were on a wholly new scale. It is hard to imagine how, after this kind of elevation in the East, and after the independent power he had exercised in reorganising vast tracts of land, Pompey could have returned to Rome to become an ordinary senator, just one among many. On the surface, that is just what he did. There was no march on the city in the style of Sulla, but underneath, there were hints of change back in Rome, too. Pompey's vast building scheme of theatre, gardens, porticos and meeting rooms, all lined with famous works of sculpture, was a decidedly imperial innovation. It was far more extensive than the individual temples commonly erected by earlier generals in thanks for the help of the gods on the battlefield had ever been. Dedicated in 55 BCE, it was the first of a series of massive architectural developments that were a hallmark of later emperors, who tried to leave their stamp in gleaming marble on the Roman cityscape, and that form our image of ancient Rome today. There are also signs that even in Rome, Pompey was presented, much like later emperors, in godlike terms. This was already a theme in Cicero's speech of 66 BCE, which repeatedly refers to Pompey's talents as divine, or endowed by the gods, singling out his incredibilis ac divina virtus, his unbelievable and godlike virtus. How literally to take the word divina is unclear, but in the Roman world it never became the completely dead metaphor that divine often is now. At the very least, there was something a bit more than human about Pompey. That is strongly implied, too, by an honour voted to him on the proposal of two tribunes in 63 BCE, in anticipation of his return from the East. Pompey was to be allowed to wear the dress of a triumphing general whenever he attended the circus races. This was much more significant than it may sound, and certainly more than a matter of dress code. For the special costume traditionally worn by the successful general in his triumphal procession was identical to the costume worn by the statue of the god Jupiter in his temple on the Capitoline Hill. It was as if military victory allowed the general literally to step into a god's shoes just for the day, which explains why the slave standing behind him in the chariot was supposed to have whispered in his ear over and over again, "Remember, you're just a man." To allow Pompey to dress up in triumphal regalia on other occasions was tantamount to giving him divine status outside that strictly defined ritual context. It must have seemed a risky step to take, for Pompey is said to have tried his new privilege only once, and that, as one Roman writer sharply observed some 70 years later, was once too often. How to balance individual achievement and celebrity with the notional equality of the elite and the principles of shared power had been a major dilemma throughout the Roman Republic. Many mythical stories of early Rome pose the problem of dashing heroes who step out of line to take on the enemy single-handedly. Did they deserve punishment for disobedience or honour for bringing victory to Rome? There were also historical figures before Pompey whose prominence had come into conflict with the traditional power structure of the state. Marius and Sulla are obvious examples. But more than 100 years before them, despite or because of his series of tremendous victories, Scipio Africanus had spent the end of his life in virtual exile after various attempts through the Roman courts to cut him down to size, hence his burial in southern Italy and not in the grand Scipio family tomb in Rome. There were even stories that he claimed divine inspiration and used to spend the night in the temple of Jupiter to take advantage of his special relationship with the god. But by the middle of the 1st century BCE, the stakes were so much bigger, the size of Rome's operations and obligations so much greater, and the resources of cash and manpower available so much larger, that the rise of men such as Pompey was more or less unstoppable. What eventually did stop Pompey was a rival in the shape of Julius Caesar, a member of an old patrician family with a political program in the radical tradition of the Gracchi, and eventually with ambitions that led directly to one-man rule. But first, the two men were part of a notorious three-cornered alliance. The Gang of Three. In 60 BCE, 2 years after he had returned to Rome, Pompey was frustrated that the Senate had not yet formally ratified his eastern settlement, instead procrastinating by confirming it piece by piece, not en bloc. And, as any general then had to do, he was looking for land on which to settle his ex-soldiers. Marcus Licinius Crassus, who had finally led Roman troops to victory against Spartacus and was reputedly the richest man in Rome, had recently taken up the case of a struggling company of state contractors. They had bid far too much for the tax rights of the province of Asia, and Crassus was trying to get them permission to renegotiate the price. Julius Caesar, the least experienced and least wealthy of the three, wanted to secure election to the consulship of 59 BCE, and a major military command to follow, not merely the policing duties against brigands in Italy that the Senate had in mind for him. Mutual support seemed the best way to achieve these various aims. So, in an entirely unofficial deal, they pooled resources, power, contacts, and ambition to get what they wanted in the short term, and in the longer. For many ancient observers, this was another milestone on the road to the breakdown of republican government. The poet Horace, looking back from the other side of that breakdown, was only one of those who singled out the year 60 BCE when he referred, according to traditional Roman dating, to the civil war that began when Metellus was consul. Cato the Younger, the great-grandson of the elder, and one of Caesar's most uncompromising enemies, argued that the city was overturned not when Caesar and Pompey fell out, but when they became friends. The idea that the political process had been fixed behind the scenes seemed in some ways worse than the open violence of the previous decades. Cicero captured the point nicely when he observed that in Pompey's notebook there was a list not only of past consuls, but of future ones, too. It was not such a complete takeover as those comments imply. There were all kinds of strains, disagreements, and rivalries between the three men, and if Pompey really did have a notebook with a list of the gang's choice of future consuls, the electoral process sometimes got the better of them, and someone quite different, not at all to their liking, was voted in. Nonetheless, they did pull off their immediate goals. Caesar was duly elected consul for 59 BCE, and, among a series of measures that strongly resembled the programs of earlier radical tribunes, sponsored legislation on behalf of the other two. He also secured a military command for himself in southern Gaul, to which a vast area on the other side of the Alps was soon added. For much of the 50s BCE, the machinations of members of the gang continued to be a major force in Roman politics, even though Caesar made only periodic visits to Italy, and Crassus never returned from the campaign he led in 55 BCE against the Parthian Empire, centred in what is now Iran, which in many ways replaced Mithridates in Roman fears. It is partly Crassus's early death that makes his role and importance within the trio difficult to assess. But the tragedy of his defeat and gory decapitation and the humiliation of the capture of his army's ceremonial standards resonated for years. The decisive Parthian victory came in 53 BCE at the Battle of Carrhae, on what is now the border between Turkey and Syria. Crassus's head was sent as a trophy to the Parthian king's residence, where it was instantly reused as a prop, standing in for the head of the tragic Pentheus, decapitated by his mother in a performance of Euripides' play The Bacchae, interestingly part of the Parthian repertoire. The standards remained a proud piece of Parthian booty until the Emperor Augustus, by some adept diplomacy dressed up as a military achievement, brought them back to Rome in 19 BCE. The controversies of this period in the mid-1st century BCE are documented in vivid micro-detail, thanks largely to the letters of Cicero, sometimes written daily and full of unsubstantiated rumours, second-guessing, hints of plots, half-truths, gossip, unreliable speculation, and foreboding. The political situation alarms me more each day, and there is a whiff of dictatorship in the air, are typical refrains among more practical exchanges about loans and debts, or triumphalist news of Caesar's daring, if very temporary, landing on Britain. They offer extraordinary evidence for politics as it happened that is unique in the classical world, and probably in any world before the 15th century CE. Yet they also tend to exaggerate the impression of confusion and political breakdown, or at least present a picture that is hard to compare with earlier periods. How disordered and cutthroat might the world of Scipio Africanus and Fabius Concator appear, had their private letters and jottings survived, rather than just the retrospective accounts of Livy and others. What is more, the overwhelming quantity of material from Cicero's pen can make it hard to see beyond his perspectives and prejudices. The career of Publius Clodius Pulcher is a case in point. Clodius first crossed swords with Cicero in a scandal at the end of 62 BCE, after a man was discovered in what was supposed to be a solemn, all-female religious festival being led by Julius Caesar's wife. Some suspected that this was a lover's tryst rather than a simple prank, and Caesar took the precaution of a speedy divorce on the famous grounds that Caesar's wife must be above suspicion. Many pointed the finger of blame at Clodius, who was put on trial, with Cicero appearing as a key witness for the prosecution. The upshot was an acquittal and lasting enmity between Clodius and Cicero, who predictably, but possibly wrongly, claimed that massive bribery had secured the verdict of not guilty. Clodius's subsequent reputation for outright villainy has been almost entirely formed by Cicero's enmity. He has gone down in history as the mad patrician who not only arranged to be adopted into a plebeian family in order to stand for the tribunate, but also put two fingers up to the whole process by choosing an adoptive father younger than himself. Once elected in 58 BCE, he engineered Cicero's exile for the tough line he had taken against Catiline's associates, introduced a series of laws that attacked the whole basis of Roman government, and terrorised the streets with his private militia. Rome was saved from this monster only when he was killed in 52 BCE after picking a fight with the slaves of one of Cicero's friends at the so-called Battle of Bovillae. No alternative views of Clodius have survived, but almost certainly the other side of the story would have made him a radical reformer in the tradition of the Gracchi. One of his laws made the distribution of grain in the city entirely free. Lynched by a reactionary thug and his hangers-on. Not even Cicero's efforts for the defence secured acquittal on the murder charge for his friend, who ended up a neighbour of Verres in exile in Marseille. The politics of the 50s BCE are a curious mixture of business as usual, perilous breakdown, and ingenious or desperate attempts to adapt traditional political rules to meet new crises as they appeared. It is hard to know what to make of Cicero in the late 50s BCE, in the safety of his study, writing about the theory of Roman politics in ways that would have been familiar to Polybius, while only a few hundred metres from his house on the Palatine. There were increasingly frequent riots in the Forum and outbreaks of violence and arson, including the torching of the Senate House for Clodius's funeral pyre. Perhaps this was his attempt to restore order, at least in his head. Others took more practical measures and devised some brave innovations. In 52 BCE, for example, after the murder of Clodius, Pompey was elected sole consul. Rather than resort to appointing a dictator to take charge of the growing crisis, with all the memories of Sulla's dictatorship, the Senate decided to give one man an office which, by definition, had always been shared between two. This time the gamble paid off. Within a few months, Pompey had not only taken firm control of the city, but also taken a colleague, albeit keeping it in the family. It was his new father-in-law. More problematic were the tactics adopted by, or forced upon, Julius Caesar's fellow consul in 59 BCE. Marcus Calpurnius Bibulus, a staunch opponent of much of the legislation Caesar was introducing. Menaced by Caesar's supporters, showered with that all too familiar vehicle of Roman disaffection, excrement, and more or less confined to his house, he was unable to voice his opposition in any of the regular ways. So he stayed at home and sent out messages announcing that he was watching the heavens for signs and omens. There was definite religious and political force behind this. The support of the gods underpinned Roman politics, and it was an essential axiom that no political decision could be taken until it was clear that there were no adverse omens. Yet watching the heavens was never intended as a means of obstructing political action indefinitely, and those on Caesar's side claimed that Bibulus was illegitimately manipulating religious rules. The issue was never resolved. It was typical of the uncertainties of the period and of the difficulties the Romans faced in making old rules solve new dilemmas that for years the status of all public business conducted in 59 BCE remained unclear. In the late 50s BCE, Cicero was still wondering about the legality of Clodius's adoption and the settlement of Pompey's veterans. Had the legislation all been properly passed or not? Very different views were possible. The most pressing political issue of the period, however, came not directly from Rome, but from Caesar in Gaul. He had left Italy in 58 BCE on a five-year command, and this was rolled on for another 5 years in 56 BCE, with the warm support, in public at least, of Cicero, who pointed to the danger of Gallic enemies, much as he had earlier pointed to the danger of Mithridates. Caesar's description of these campaigns in the seven volumes of his Commentaries on the Gallic War, an edited version of his official annual dispatches from the front line, sent back to Rome, starts with its famous clinical opener. Gallia est omnis divisia in partes tres. The whole of Gaul is divided into three parts. It ranks alongside Xenophon's description, the Anabasis, or going up, of his exploits, with a Greek mercenary army, written in the 4th century BCE, as the only detailed eyewitness account of any ancient warfare to survive. It is not exactly a neutral document. Caesar had a shrewd eye for his public image, and the Commentaries is a carefully contrived justification of his conduct and parade of his military skills. But it is also an early example of what we might call imperial ethnography. Unlike Cicero, whose letters from Cilicia betray no interest whatsoever in the local surroundings, Caesar was deeply engaged with the foreign customs he witnessed, from the drinking habits of the Gauls, including the barbaric prohibition of wine among some tribes, to the religious rituals of the Druids. His is a wonderfully Roman vision of people whom he clearly did not entirely understand, but it still forms the basic reference point for modern discussion of the culture of pre-Roman Northern Europe, an irony given that it was a culture he was in the process of changing forever. Reading between the lines of the commentaries, anyone will see that both genuine Roman anxieties about enemies in the north and Caesar's desire to outstrip in military glory any of his rivals drove the decade of warfare in Gaul. Caesar ended up bringing more territory under Roman control than Pompey had in the east, and crossing over what Romans called the ocean, the waterway that separated the known world from the great unknown, to set foot briefly on the remote and exotic island of Britain. It was a symbolic victory that resonated loudly back home, even earning a passing reference in a poem by Catullus when he wrote about going to visit the memorials of Caesar the Great, the Rhine in Gaul and the terrible sea and the faraway Britons. In doing this, Caesar laid the foundations for the political geography of modern Europe, as well as slaughtering up to 1 million people over the whole region. It would be wrong to imagine that the Gauls were peace-loving innocents brutally trampled by Caesar's forces. One Greek visitor in the early 1st century BCE had been shocked to find enemy heads casually pinned up at the entrance to Gallic houses, though he conceded that, after a while, one got used to the sight. And Gallic mercenaries had done good business in Italy until the power of Rome had closed their market. Yet the mass killing of those who stood in Caesar's way was more than even some Romans could take. Cato, driven partly, no doubt, by his enmity of Caesar, and speaking from partisan as well as humanitarian motives, suggested that he should be handed over to those tribes whose women and children he had put to death. Pliny the Elder, trying later to arrive at a head count of Caesar's victims, seems strikingly modern in accusing him of a crime against humanity. The pressing question was what would happen when Caesar left Gaul, and how, after almost 10 years there, from 58 BCE, with the power and wealth he had accumulated, he was to be reintegrated into the ordinary mainstream of politics. As often, Romans debated this in highly legal terms. There were fierce and technical controversies about the precise date on which his military command was supposed to come to an end, and whether he would then be allowed to move directly, without a break, into another consulship. For any period, as a private citizen out of office would provide a window for a prosecution, among other things, over the questionable legality of his acts in 59 BCE. On the one hand were those who, for whatever reasons, personal or principled, wanted to bring Caesar back down to size. On the other, Caesar and his supporters insisted that his treatment was humiliating, that his dignitas, a distinctively Roman combination of clout, prestige, and right to respect, was being attacked. The underlying issue was brutally straightforward. Would Caesar, with more than 40,000 troops at his disposal, only a few days from Italy, follow the example of Sulla or Pompey? Pompey himself cautiously remained on the sidelines, almost up to the final breakdown, and in the middle of 50 BCE was still trying to find Caesar a reasonably honourable exit strategy. In December of that year, the Senate voted by a majority of 370-22 that Caesar and Pompey should simultaneously give up their commands. Pompey was actually in Rome at the time, but since 55 BCE, thanks to another piece of ingenuity, he had been the governor of Spain, doing the job remotely, through deputies, an unprecedented arrangement that became a standard feature of the rule of the emperors. It is the clearest sign of the impotence of the Senate at this point that, in response to this overwhelming vote, Pompey took no notice and Caesar, after a few more rounds of fruitless negotiation, marched into Italy. Throwing the dice. Sometime around the 10th of January, 49 BCE, Julius Caesar, with just one of his legions from Gaul, crossed the Rubicon, the river that marked the northern boundary of Italy. The exact date is not known, or even the location of this most historically significant of rivers. It was more likely a small brook than the raging torrent of popular imagination, and, despite the efforts of ancient writers to embellish them with dramatic appearances of the gods, uncanny omens, and prophetic dreams, the reality of the surroundings was probably mundane. For us, to cross the Rubicon has come to mean to pass the point of no return. It did not mean that to Caesar. According to one of his companions on the journey, Gaius Asinius Pollio, historian, senator, and founder of Rome's first public library, when he finally approached the Rubicon after some hesitation, Caesar quoted in Greek two words from the Athenian comic playwright Menander, literally in a phrase borrowed from gambling, "Let the dice be thrown," despite the usual English translation, "The die is cast," which again appears to hint at the irrevocable step being taken. Caesar's Greek was much more an expression of uncertainty, a sense that everything now was in the lap of the gods. Let's throw the dice in the air and see where they will fall. Who knows what will happen next? What did happen next was 4 years of civil war. Some of Caesar's supporters in Rome rushed to join him in northern Italy, while Pompey was pushed into the command of the anti-Caesarians and decided to leave Italy and fight from his power base in the east. In 48 BCE, his forces were defeated at the Battle of Pharsalus in northern Greece, and Pompey was murdered soon after that when he tried to take refuge in Egypt. But despite his famed speed, celeritas was one of his watchwords, Caesar still took 3 more years until 45 BCE to overcome his Roman adversaries in Africa and Spain, as well as to squash trouble from Pharnaces, the son and usurper of Mithridates. Between crossing the Rubicon and his death in March 44 BCE, Caesar made only fleeting visits to Rome, the longest was the 5-month stretch from October 45 BCE. From the point of view of the city, he became a largely absent dictator. In some ways, this civil war between Pompey and Caesar was as odd as the social war. How many people it directly involved is impossible to say. The priority of many of the inhabitants of Italy and of the empire was probably to avoid getting inadvertently caught up in the struggles of rival armies, and to keep clear of the crime wave that the war unleashed in Italy. Only occasionally do such ordinary people on the margins get even a small share of the limelight. The captain of a trading ship, Gaius Paticius, who kindly picked up a bedraggled Pompey from the Greek coast after the Battle of Pharsalus, is one. Soterides, a eunuch priest, who inscribed on stone his worries about his male partner, who had sailed off with a party of local volunteers and been taken prisoner, is another. Of the partisans, on one side were the backers of Caesar, with his popular political program and clear leanings towards one-man rule. Cicero assumed that this was where the sympathies and interests of the poor naturally lay. On the other side were a motley group of those who, for various reasons, did not like what Caesar was up to or the powers he seemed to be seeking. A few were probably as high-principled as they were unrealistic. As Cicero once said of Cato, "He talks as if he were in the Republic of Plato, when in fact he is in the crap of Romulus." But it was only later, in the romantic nostalgia under the early emperors, that they were reinvented en bloc as fully-fledged freedom fighters and martyrs united in the struggle against autocracy. The irony was that Pompey, their figurehead, was no less an autocrat than Caesar. Whichever side won, as Cicero again observed, the result was set to be much the same: slavery for Rome. What came to be seen as a war between liberty and one-man rule was really a war to choose between rival emperors. One major change, however, was that Roman civil war now involved almost all the known world. Whereas the wars between Sulla and his rivals had witnessed occasional incidents in the east, the war between the Caesarians and the Pompeians played out right across the Mediterranean, from Spain to Greece and Asia Minor. Famous names met their ends in far-flung places. Bibulus, Caesar's unfortunate colleague in 59 BCE, died at sea near Corfu as he was trying to blockade the Greek coast. The murderer of Clodius, Titus Annius Milo, left his exile to join a Pompeian uprising and fell in the toe of Italy, hit by a flying stone. Cato, once it was clear that Caesar was the inevitable victor, killed himself at the town of Utica, on the coast of what is now Tunisia, in the most gory way imaginable. According to his biographer, writing 150 years later, he stabbed himself with his sword but survived the gash. Despite attempts by friends and family to save him, he pushed away the doctor they had summoned and pulled out his own bowels through the still open wound. Egypt had a significant supporting role too. It was there that Pompey, the man who had once ruled the Roman world, met his ignominious end in 48 CE. He was expecting a warm welcome as he put to shore. In fact, he was decapitated by the henchmen of a local dynast who calculated that disposing of the enemy leader would ingratiate him with Caesar. Reflecting on this moment, many Roman observers, Cicero included, agreed that it would have been far better for Pompey to have died a couple of years earlier, when he fell seriously ill in 50 BCE. As it was, his life lasted longer than his power. The murder, however, proved a wrong move for its perpetrators. Caesar, who turned up a few days later, apparently wept as he was presented with Pompey's pickled head, and shortly backed one of the rivals to the throne of Egypt. That rival was Queen Cleopatra VII, best known for her alliance, political and romantic, with Mark Antony in the next round of Roman civil wars. But at this point, her interests lay with Caesar, with whom she had an open affair and, if her claims about paternity are to be believed, a child. Back in Rome, Caesar's triumphal processions paraded spoils, animate and inanimate, from across the Roman world. His triumph of 46 BCE, celebrated during one of his brief visits to the city, displayed not only the Gallic rebel Vercingetorix, but also Cleopatra's half-sister, who had been on the wrong side of the Egyptian power struggles. She was now put on show next to a working model of the Lighthouse of Alexandria. Caesar's victory over Mithridates' son, Pharnaces, who had died in battle near the Black Sea, was commemorated in the same celebration by a single placard on which was written one of the world's most famous slogans ever, Veni, Vidi, Vici, I came, I saw, I conquered, intended to capture the speed of Caesar's success. But there were alarming signs, too, in the images of Caesar's Roman victims. Triumphal processions were supposed to celebrate victories over foreign enemies, not citizens of Rome. Caesar put on show shocking paintings of the dying moments of leading figures on the Pompeian side, from Cato disemboweling himself to Metellus Scipio throwing himself into the sea. The distaste of many people for this particular kind of triumphalism was registered in the tears of the crowds as these images were carried past. In retrospect, it was an uncanny foretaste of Caesar's bloody fate less than 2 years later. The Ides of March. Julius Caesar was murdered on the 15th of March 44 BCE, the Ides on the Roman dating system. In parts of the Mediterranean world, the civil war had by no means ended. Pompey's son, Sextus, still had a force of at least 6 legions in Spain and was continuing to fight for his father's cause. But Caesar was mustering a vast force of almost 100,000 soldiers for an attack on the Parthian Empire, a revenge for the ignominious defeat of Crassus at Carrhae, and a useful opportunity for military glory against a foreign rather than a Roman enemy. It was just a few days before he was due to leave for the East on the 18th of March that a group of 20 or so disgruntled senators, supported actively or passively by a few dozen more, killed him. Appropriately, the deed took place in a new Senate House, which Pompey had built into his new theatre complex, in front of a statue of himself, which ended up splattered with Caesar's blood. Thanks in part to the reworking of the theme in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, the murder of the Roman dictator, in the name of Libertas, has been the template for last-ditch opposition to tyranny and for principled assassinations ever since. It was no coincidence, for example, that John Wilkes Booth used Ides as the code for the day on which he planned to kill Abraham Lincoln. But as a backwards glance through Roman history shows, this was the last in a series of murders of popular, radical, but arguably too powerful politicians that started with the lynching of Tiberius Gracchus in 133 BCE. The question must be, what was Caesar trying to do, and what made him so unacceptable to this group of senators that assassination seemed the only way out? Despite his rare appearances in Rome, Caesar initiated a vast programme of reforms, going beyond even the scale of Sulla's. One of them governs life even now. For, with some help from the specialist scientists he met in Alexandria, Caesar introduced into Rome what has become the modern Western system of timekeeping. The traditional Roman year was only 355 days long, and it had for centuries been the job of Roman priests to add in an extra month from time to time to keep the civic calendar in step with the natural seasons. For whatever reason, probably a combination of lack of expertise and lack of will, they had signally failed to get their calculations correct. The result was that the calendar year and the natural year were sometimes many weeks apart, with the Roman equivalent of harvest festivals falling when the crops were still growing, and the climate in what was called April feeling more like February, which it was. The truth is that it is always dangerous in Republican history to assume that any given date is an accurate indication of the weather. Using Alexandrian know-how, Caesar corrected the error and, for the future, established a year with 365 days, with an extra day inserted at the end of February every 4 years. This was a far more significant outcome of his visit to Egypt than any dalliance with Cleopatra. Other measures harked back to familiar themes from the previous 100 years. Caesar launched, for example, a large number of new overseas colonies to resettle the poor from the city of Rome. Following up Gaius Gracchus's initiative with a successful foundation at Carthage. It was this, presumably, that allowed him to get away with reducing the number of recipients of free grain by about half, to 150,000 in all. He also extended Roman citizenship to those living in the far north of Italy, beyond the River Po, and at least proposed granting Latin status to the population of Sicily. But he had even more ambitious plans to overhaul Roman government, including attempts to regularise, even micromanage, all kinds of aspects of civic organisation, both in Rome and throughout Italy. These ranged from questions of who could hold office in local Italian communities, no grave diggers, pimps, actors or auctioneers, unless they were retired, to issues of road maintenance, householders to be responsible for the footpath in front of their house, and traffic management, no heavy goods vehicles in Rome during the daytime, except for the purpose of temple building or repair, or for removing demolition rubble. Caesar also became part of the calendar, as well as rewriting it. It may not have been until after his assassination that the month Quintilis was renamed Julius, or July, after him. Roman writers do not always make the chronology clear, but it was overweening honours of that sort, voted during his lifetime by a compliant senate, combined with his more or less official takeover of the democratic process, that provoked the deadly opposition. This went far beyond his head on the coinage. He was allowed to wear triumphal dress almost wherever he liked, including the triumphal laurel wreath, which he found convenient for disguising his bald patch. Temples and a priesthood in his honour seemed to have been promised too, and his statue was placed in all the existing temples of Rome. His private house was even to be decorated with a triangular gable or pediment to give it the appearance of a temple, the home of a god. Almost worse within the Roman context were the strong hints that he was aiming at becoming a king. On one famous but rather murky occasion, just a month before his assassination, his loyal lieutenant and one of the consuls of the year, Mark Antony, used the religious festival of the Lupercalia to offer Caesar a royal crown. It was obviously a carefully choreographed piece of propaganda, and it may have been designed as a test of public opinion. Would the watching crowd cheer when Caesar was offered the crown or not? If it did, would that be a cue to accept? Even at the time, Caesar's response and the overall message were disputed. Did he, as Cicero thought, ask Antony to send the crown to the temple of Jupiter, the god who Caesar insisted was the only king of Rome? Or was it thrown to the audience and then put on a statue of Caesar? It was suspiciously unclear whether he was saying, "No, thank you," or "Yes, please." Even if it was "no, thank you," his position as dictator in various forms from 49 BCE seems pernicious to some. He was first appointed to the office for a short term to conduct elections to the consulship for the next year, an entirely traditional procedure, except for the entirely untraditional fact that he oversaw the election of himself. In 48 BCE, after his victory at the Battle of Pharsalus, the Senate again made him dictator for a year, and then in 46 BCE for 10 years. Finally, by the start of 44 BCE, he had become dictator for life. To the average observer, the difference between that and king must have been hard to discern. Under the terms of his dictatorship, Caesar had the right directly to nominate some candidates for election, and he controlled the other elections behind the scenes more efficiently than Pompey had done with his notebook of future consuls' names. At the end of 45 BCE, he caused a particular stir when the death of one of the sitting consuls was announced on the very last day of the year. Caesar instantly convened an assembly to elect one of his friends, Caius Caninius Rebilus, to the vacant post for just half a day. This prompted a flood of jokes from Cicero. Caninius was such an extraordinarily vigilant consul that he never once went to sleep in his whole term of office. In the consulship of Caninius, you may take it, no one had breakfast. Who were the consuls when Caninius was consul? But Cicero was also outraged, as were many conservatives, for this was almost worse than fixing the elections. It was not taking the elected offices of the Roman Republic seriously. What might now appear to be Caesar's best quality was, ironically, the one most flagrantly at odds with Republican tradition. He made much of his clementia, or mercy. He pardoned rather than punished his enemies, and he made a display of renouncing cruel retribution against fellow Romans, provided they gave up their opposition to him. Cato, Metellus Scipio, and most Gauls were quite another matter, and deserved all they got. Caesar had pardoned several of his future assassins, Brutus among them, after they had fought on the Pompeian side in the civil war. In many ways, Clementia was the political slogan of Caesar's dictatorship, yet it provoked as much opposition as gratitude, for the simple reason that, virtue though it may have been in some respects, it was an entirely monarchical one. Only those with the power to do otherwise can exercise mercy. Clementia, in other words, was the antithesis of republican libertas. Cato was said to have killed himself to escape it. So it was not just a case of simple ingratitude when Brutus and the others turned on the man who had given them a second chance. It was partly that. It was partly motivated by self-interest and disgruntlement, driven by the assassin's sense of dignitas. But they were also defending one view of liberty and one view of the importance of republican traditions going back in Rome's mythology to the moment when Brutus's distant ancestor was instrumental in expelling the Tarquins and became one of the first pair of consuls. In fact, the design of a silver coin later issued by the assassins underscores that very point by featuring the distinctive hat, the pileus, or cap of liberty, that slaves wore when they were granted their freedom. The message was that the Roman people had been liberated. Or had they? As we shall see, it turned out to be a very odd sort of freedom. If the assassination of Julius Caesar became a model for the effective removal of a tyrant, it was also a powerful reminder that getting rid of a tyrant did not necessarily dispose of tyranny. Despite all the slogans, the bravado and the high principles, what the assassins actually brought about and what the people got was a long civil war and the permanent establishment of one-man rule. But that is the story of Chapter 9. First, we must turn to some of the equally important aspects of the history of Rome that lay behind the politics and the headlines. Chapter 8. The Home Front, Public and Private. One side of the history of Rome is a history of politics, of war, of victory and defeat, of citizenship and of everything that went on in public between prominent men. I have outlined one dramatic version of that history as Rome transformed from a small, unimpressive town next to the Tiber into first a local and eventually an international power base. Almost every aspect of that transformation was contested and sometimes literally fought over. The rights of the people against the Senate, the questions of what liberty meant and how it was to be guaranteed, the control that was or was not to be exercised over conquered territory, the impact of empire, for good or bad, on traditional Roman politics and values. In the process, a version of citizenship was somehow invented that was new in the classical world. Greeks had occasionally shared citizenship on an ad hoc basis between two cities, but the idea that it was the norm, as the Romans insisted, to be a citizen of two places, to count two places as home, was fundamental to Roman success on the battlefield and elsewhere, and it has proved influential right up into the 21st century. This was a Roman revolution, and we are its heirs. There are, nevertheless, some elusive sides to this story. It is only occasionally possible to discover the part in the grand narrative of Roman history up to the 1st century BCE that ordinary people, the women, the poor, or the slaves, played. We have found just a few cameo appearances. The frightened comedian on the stage at Asculum, the loud-mouthed servant who unwisely abused the supporters of Gaius Gracchus, the eunuch priest who worried about his friend in the civil war, even the poor cat trapped in the fire that destroyed the hut at Fidenae. There is much more evidence for all these groups in later periods, and they figure more prominently in the rest of this book. But what survives for the early centuries of Roman history tends to offer a one-sided picture of the priorities even of the elite Roman man. It is easy to get the impression that the main characters in the story were concerned with the big issues of Roman political power, to the exclusion of anything else, as if the proud conquests, military prowess, and the election to political office that are blazoned on their tombstones were the be-all and end-all of their existence. They were not. We have already glimpsed a few other aspects of their lives and interests, enjoying boy-meet-girl comedies on the stage, writing and learning poetry, and listening to literary lectures given by visiting Greek ambassadors. It is not hard to imagine something of the day-to-day world of Polybius in Rome as he pondered on the funerals he attended, or shrewdly decided to claim sickness on the day a fellow hostage made his escape attempt. Nor is it hard to recapture something of the fun that the elder Cato must have had, thinking up his stunt with the Carthaginian figs dropping out of his toga. But it is only in the 1st century BCE that we begin to have rich evidence for all the things that preoccupied the Roman elite, beyond war and politics. These range from curiosity about the language they spoke. One prolific scholar devoted 25 books to a history of Latin, its grammar and etymology, to intense scientific speculation on the origins of the universe and theological debate on the nature of the gods. Lucretius's eloquent dissection of the folly of fearing death in his philosophical poem On the Nature of Things, De Rerum Natura, is one of the highlights of classical literature and a beacon of good sense even now. Those who do not exist cannot regret their non-existence, as part of the argument runs. But by far the most sustained insight into the interests, concerns, pleasures, fears, and problems of one notable Roman comes from the 1,000 or so private letters to and from Cicero that were collected, edited, and made public after his death in 43 BCE, and have been read and studied ever since. They contain, as we have seen, plenty of gossip from the highest echelons of Roman politics, and they throw rare light on the front line of provincial government as Cicero experienced it in Cilicia. But no less important, they reveal what else was claiming Cicero's attention while he was facing down Catiline, dealing with the Gang of Three, planning military strikes on troublesome locals, or deciding where his loyalties lay in civil war. Alongside those political and military crises, at the same time, he was worrying about money, dowries and marriages, his daughters and his own, grieving at the death of those he loved, divorcing his wife, complaining about an upset stomach after an unusual menu at dinner, attempting to track down runaway slaves, and trying to acquire some nice statues to decorate one of his many houses. For the first, and almost the only time in Roman history, these letters allow us to take a close look at what was going on behind one Roman front door. This chapter follows up some of those themes in Cicero's letters. We will start with his experience of civil war and of the dictatorship of Julius Caesar, by turns messy and darkly funny, and about as far from the ringing public slogans of Libertas and Clementia as you could imagine. Then move on to some of the fundamental questions that can get lost in all the political controversies, diplomatic negotiations and military campaigns. How long did Romans expect to live? At what age did people get married? What rights did women have? Where did the money come from to support the lavish lifestyles of the rich and privileged? And what about the slaves? The other sides of civil war. In 49 BCE, after many weeks of indecision, and despite his realistic sense that there was not much to choose between Caesar and Pompey, Cicero decided not to remain neutral in the civil war, but to join the Pompeians and sail for their camp in northern Greece. Although not quite in the league of either of the protagonists, he was still a significant enough figure that neither side wanted him as a declared enemy. But some of his irritating habits made Cicero an unpopular member of Pompey's squad. His fellow fighters could not stand the way he went around the barracks with a scowl on his face, while trying to relieve the tension by cracking feeble jokes. "So why not employ him as a guardian of your children, then?" he retorted, when a decidedly inappropriate candidate was promoted to a command position on the grounds that he was mild-mannered and sensible. When the day of the Battle of Pharsalus came, Cicero used Polybius's tactic and was conveniently off sick. After the defeat, rather than move on from Greece to Africa with some of the hardliners, he returned directly to Italy to wait for an amnesty from Caesar. Cicero's letters from this period, about 400 in all, reveal something of the tawdriness and the terrors of civil war, as well as the disorganisation, the misunderstanding, the backstabbing, the personal ambitions, even the bathos of this or any conflict and its aftermath. They offer a useful